He found a crayfish. It fit perfectly in his palm. He studied it closely. It looked weird and funny. He tried to imagine the world as seen through the black poppy seeds of its eyes sitting on spindly stalks. What a stupid creature. What were its days like? What was its life? Crawling around this dreary itsy-bitsy pool, choking on fish shit, eating garbage. It had no clue about the world outside its filthy puddle, did it? Dumb is as dumb does, as his mother would say, which had always struck Shelley as a dumb expression, something only a dumb person would say. How would it feel to pull the crayfish apart? He didn't mean how would the crayfish feel. He didn't care about that. And anyway, with its piece of lint brain and elementary nerves, it may not feel anything. Distantly, Shelley considered that possibility, that this creature could watch itself be shredded like paper and feel nothing, caring not at all. Oh, there goes my leg. Never mind. And there goes my other one. Oops, now I can't see. My eyes must be gone. Shelley was something of a sensualist. He relished touch, pressure. How would it feel, physically, to take this creature apart? Would its pincers snap at his fingers as he pulled? Would its stupid crustacean anatomy fight its own dismemberment, that wonderful tension as he pulled each limb off, the sucking pip as this or that part detached from the whole? The crayfish could fight, yes, and dimly Shelley sort of hoped it would, but it wouldn't matter. He wasn't scared of being bitten or clawed, plus he was so much bigger. As usual with Shelley, if he wanted to do something, and if nobody was watching, he simply did as he liked. He pinched one of the crayfish's comical little eyes. It ruptured with a mildly satisfying pop. The texture was grainy, a tiny ball of honeycomb candy coming apart. The remnants were stuck on his finger like the shards of a very small and dark Christmas tree ornament. The crayfish spasmed in his palm, jackknifing open and closed. Shelley was transfixed. His eyes took on a hard sheen, saliva collected in his mouth, a gossamer strand of spit repelling over his quivering lower lip. He burst the crayfish's other eye. He carefully pulled off one of its pincers, relishing that thrilling sensation. Pip! The pinky, translucent claw continued to open and close even when separated from the body. He dropped it and watched it sink, opening and closing. Hey, Shell, Ephraim called over. Newt's going to light the one-match fire. We need you as a windbreak. Newton was in charge of the fire. The boys were content to let him take the lead. Besides, Newton was the best at almost all the basic survival skills, firecraft and orienteering and berry identification. Newton lit the pile of old man's beard and nursed the fledgling flickers. Fingers of flame crawled up the bleached wood. They crouched around the fire to soak in its heat. Sunlight painted a honey gold inlay on the slack water between the waves. My grandma died of cancer, Ephraim said suddenly. Liver cancer. Max said, What? Ephraim gave him a look. Just listen to me. Her skin went yellow. All she could get down were those meal replacement things that old people drink. Ensure. Her hair came out because of the radiation chamber they stuck her in to kill the cancer. He exhaled heavily, blowing his dark locks off his forehead. When I saw that guy this morning, the first thing I thought about was Grandma. The man hadn't entered their thoughts directly, but he'd been hovering at the margins all day. His sick-looking face, his matchstick arms and legs, the sweet smell of the cabin. Ephraim's streamlined and unconventionally handsome face took on a rare pensive aspect. What do you think's the matter with him? Kent grabbed the stone and hurled it into the water with a vicious sweep of his arm. Who knows, Eph? If it's cancer, then it's cancer, right? People get cancer. Kent stared at the others with savage solemnity. Maybe he's got, what do you call it, Alpiners or whatever. Alzheimer's, Newton said. What the fuck ever, Newt, he's got that. He's too young, Newton said. That's an old people's disease. You guys are being babies. Kent said, drawing the last word out. Babies. My dad said the most obvious conclusion is usually the right one, 99.99% of the time. So what's the most obvious conclusion? Shelley asked, his vapid face oriented on Kent. His skin looked like it was melting. The boys fell silent. I just think the guy is sick is all, Max said after a while, and I've been thinking about it. So have I, said Ephraim. And me, Newt said. Kent snorted. Tim's a doctor, isn't he? That's his job, isn't it? By the time we get back, he better have everything sorted out. He kicked the fire apart, scattering bits of flaming driftwood. Before departing, Newton gathered the still glowing sticks and doused them in the ocean. Scout's Law Number 4, honor and respect nature in all her abundance. Evidence Log, Case 518C, Piece T11, Personal Effects. Counseling Diary of Newton Thornton, recovered from Site T, 34 Skylark Road, North Point, Prince Edward Island, by Officer Brian Skelly, Badge 908. Dear Dr. Harley, I'll compose this like a letter because I write a lot. I've got pen pals in Australia, England, and Dubuque, Iowa. Who doesn't like opening the mailbox and finding a letter from a friend, even one you've never met in person? So, a confession, huh? You think I keep things bottled up and confession's good for the soul, right? I'd talk more if people, the other kids at school gave two cruds what I have to say. Most times they'll just laugh, call me a nerd, a geek, call me fat. Call me a nerdy, fatty, fat geek, which is overkill, right? Nerds and geeks are pretty much the same. So I don't talk much, except to my teachers and my mom, and now you. The thing is, you can be a different person in letters, on the internet, too. Because there, you're not you. Okay, so yes, you are, but not the physical you. So not fat, it's glandular. Sweaty, it's also glandular. Weird, for North Point, anyway. I don't like bow hunting or spear fishing or killing things. I'm too clumsy for stickball, and I actually like Anne of Green Gables. So yeah, weird. And awkward, and gawky, and according to Ephraim Elliott, sometimes I smell like rotten corn, like when you shuck an ear and it's all black inside. By the way, I hear you're counseling Eph, too. You're doing a good job. He hasn't given me a wet willy, a rooster peck, or a titty twister in like a month. But online, I'm not that person. I can be my very best self. According to Mom, I'm a sensitive boy. Also, I'm a polymath, which means I know a little bit about everything, which, okay, is nerdy. Online, I can be my brain without my body. So, the confession. Forgive me, Father. Ha. Anyway, you won't tell anyone. Patient-doctor confidentiality. I read about it. A year ago, my cousin Sherwood died. He lived in Manitoba. He fell asleep in a field and a combine ran him over. He tried to run, but those combines are like 40 feet of whirring blades. At his funeral, the coffin stayed closed. I loved Sherwood. We hardly got to see each other. We don't have a lot of money. I don't even know how Mom affords you. And Sherwood's parents are farmers. But every summer they came for a visit. I'd take Sher to the ocean. No ocean in Manitoba, right? We got along great. When I told him a little nugget of info, Sher was genuinely interested. We stuck to out-of-the-way places, the ones only I knew. I didn't want to run across any kids from school. They'd call me lard bucket or tub of guts. I was scared that if Sher saw that, he wouldn't like me anymore, which wasn't really fair to him. Sher would have helped me, because blood is thicker than water, right? Sher was tall with wide shoulders and lots of muscle, farm boy muscles, he called them, laughing and telling me everyone had them back home. He wasn't so special. But Sher was special. Handsome. I can say that about another boy. It's not weird. And people just, they gravitated to him, is I think the word. Like a magnet drawing iron filings. Everyone wanted to be around Sher. Then he died. A stupid, unlucky accident, and everyone was so sad. The world had lost a great light. Everyone said so. I wondered what they'd have said if it was me who died. I didn't really want to guess. After the funeral, I dug out my box of photos. My mom bought me a Polaroid for my birthday, and it got a lot of use. Mainly, they were of Sher. I was the one snapping the photos, plus I don't like how I look on camera. I was going to put up a memorial wall on Facebook, right? Something to remember Sher by. My idea, sincerely. But somewhere along the line, it changed. I scanned the photos, put them in a file on my computer, but instead of a memorial wall, I created a person. I guess that's what I did, yeah. Alex Markson, the boy's name. I don't know where I got it from, but it seemed a strong name. It fit well with the photos. Alex Markson had Sherwood's face and body. Alex Markson had my words, my interests. Alex was me and Sherwood combined. I put up the profile. I knew it was wrong. My heart hammered like a drum when Sher's face went pop up on the screen. It was sacrilegious. I almost deleted it. Almost. I started posting stuff. Nothing much at first, just things that interested me. The stuff kids around here pick on me for. My words pasted to Sher's body. The super weird thing is, Alex started to get friend requests. I mean, a lot. People neither of us had met. Not weirdos, either. Normal, cool people. Boys. And girls. My age. At first, I was scared to accept them. I saw Sher up in heaven shaking his head. But after a while, I did. People posted on my wall, and I'd post on theirs, as Alex. Sher's face bloomed like a flower on strangers' Facebook pages. But the thing is, Alex's interests were mine, and people thought he was smart and funny and, well, cool. Isn't that weird? When I say those exact same things, it's nerdy because people think I'm a nerd, like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So then, and this is really embarrassing, I sent some requests to Max Kirkwood and Ephraim Elliott and Kent Jenks. I even sent one to Trudy Dennison, who sits in front of me in homeroom and is the most beautiful, funniest, and just all-around best girl in the whole entire world. Not that I've ever really talked to her, except for that time she borrowed a pencil in social studies, which she never gave back, come to think of it. Maybe she thinks borrow means keep, same as Kent does. Probably she just forgot. Anyway, guess what? They accepted, even though they never met Alex. How could they, right? They just thought he was handsome and loose and cool. I thought, this is how it could be. If I was me, if I existed in a different body, an acceptable body, a body everyone loved, if I didn't live in North Point, where I'm like this train on rails, I know where I'm going, hate it, but can't change course. This was who I could have been if the ball had bounced just a little differently, you know? My own Facebook page has 10 friends. My mom, a few uncles and aunts, my grandmother. I bought you a new pair of jeans from the Husky department at Simpson Sears in Charlottetown, Nudie. And a few pen pals. My pal from Dubuque defriended me. Now, here's the big confession, Dr. Harley. The solid gold bonanza, the secret that says just about everything, I guess. Alex Markson isn't friends with Newton Thornton. Not on Facebook. Not anywhere on Earth or in this life. Sincerely, Newton Thornton. Chapter 11. It was dark by the time they returned to the cabin. A fire flickered in a ring of rocks. Scoutmaster Tim was sitting on the far side. The tendons on his neck stood out in sharp relief. They looked like tiny trees all tenting inward. "Don't go inside," he told them. "My warm coat's in there," Kent said. "The fire's warm. You'll be fine." I'd rather have my coat. I don't care what you'd rather have, Tim said in a dead voice. The man inside is sick, sick in a way I've never seen before, at least not that I can diagnose here. The boys settled themselves around the fire. Newton said, sick how? At first, I thought cancer. As a doctor, that's always the first thought. But cancer is almost always typified by loss of appetite, and... Tim saw no good reason to tell the boys that the man had stirred that afternoon, lunged upward like a heart-staked vampire from its coffin, his eyes crawling with burst vessels, his tongue a knot of sinew as if something had sucked the saliva out of it. The man had sunk his teeth into the Chesterfield and torn at the fabric with savage bites. The mindlessness of it had horrified Tim. Tim managed to sedate him before he swallowed too much. There was a good chance he'd choked to death on the Chesterfield's musty old foam. He cradled the man's neck as he laid him down. The man's head tilted back and his jaw hung open. Tim had seen something. If anything, it resembled a white knuckle of bone, the bone of a greenstick fracture except curved and gleaming, visible only for a harried instant. Lodged in his throat below the epiglottal bulb, gently ribbed and somehow gill-like. Next, the man's ribcage bulged in a bone-splintering flex as something settled. And this man is very hungry, Tim finished. So what are you going to do about it? Said Kent. Tim ignored the boy's cheeky defiance. He may have some kind of internal sickness. By the time the boat picks us up, I believe he'll be dead. Newton said, can you operate on him? Shelley said, cut him open. Tim said, I haven't done a lot of surgery, but I know the basics. Max, has your dad ever had you help him out on the job? Max's father was the county coroner, also its taxidermist. If anyone wanted his trophy bluefin mounted on a burled oak backing, he was the one to call. An insistent voice in Tim's head told him not to involve the boys, keep them clear of this. But a new voice, a silky whisper, told him, no worries, it'd be just fine. You've got it all under control, Tim. He didn't, though. He'd become hyper-aware of this fact. This night would determine whether the man lived or died, maybe only a few hours of the night. This was why he would have bombed as a surgeon. Tim lacked the quick-cut instincts, that private triage room in his head. He was a thinker, an overthinker. Overthinking matters was just a harmless quirk in a GP, but now, when swift action was needed, he could feel himself coming apart. I've helped taxidermy animals, Max said. Helped in what way? Threading needles with catgut, shining up the glass eye and like that? It's an internship, said the voice in Tim's head. Consider it an early residency. Max's folks wouldn't mind, would they? A man's life is at risk, right? Max is smart, Max is careful, and you can protect him should anything happen. Tim pointed at the others. You all stay here. No arguments. This guy... I don't know what's the matter. He may be viral. Ephraim said, viral? Like he's catching, Kent said. You know, contagious. You sure, Scoutmaster? Newt said. I mean, Max is just a... Boy, was the word Newton swallowed. Just a boy, and Tim was taking him into a cabin occupied by a man who was sick in some unknowable way. Tim's left eye twitched. The nerve gone haywire, plicka plicka plicka, like the shutter on a camera. He squeezed his eye shut, slowly counted to five in his head. A small, persistent, maddening voice deep within the runnels of his brain was now asking questions. What are you doing, Tim? Are you really sure, Tim? The voice's cold, stentorian tone reminded him of HAL 9000, the computer in 2001, A Space Odyssey. It wouldn't shut up, kept nattering on with icy certainty. Just what do you think you're doing, Tim? He was dimly terrified that this was the voice of common sense, the logical voice that he'd listened to all his adult life, and that he was gradually abandoning it. "You don't have to do this, Max," Ephraim said. His gaze fell upon the scoutmaster. "He doesn't have to, does he?" Tim swallowed. He'd begun to do so compulsively. It felt like a pebble had gotten lodged in his throat. "No, no, but I don't think I can do it alone. And we will take all precautions." Max said, "It'll be safe?" Tim swallowed, swallowed. "Are you sure, Tim? Is this really?" "It will be fine. You can handle it." A new voice rose over HAL 9000's prissy hectoring, a louder, more imposing voice belonging to a man of action. It crowded out the other voice, which was just fine. Tim was tired of listening to it. "It's safe," Tim said. The new voice said, "It's safe enough anyway." Tim hooked his thumb at Max. "Now come on." Chapter 12. The air inside the cabin was sickly sweet. Closing his eyes, Max could picture himself under a canopy of tropical fronds hung with fruits swollen with decay. Tim splashed rubbing alcohol on a long strip of gauze. "Press this over your mouth and nose. No matter what happens, Max, don't take it off." "Aren't you wearing one?" "I don't know if that matters so much now." Tim had been busy. He'd already set up a crude operating theater on the table, suture needles threaded with filament, scalpels, hypodermic needles and vials, a bottle of scotch, and a soldering iron. "I scrounged that out of Oliver McCanty's boat," Tim said, pointing to the iron. "I might be able to cauterize the bigger blood vessels with it." The cupboards hung open. Max saw empty hot dog wrappers and bun bags in the trash. A huge sack of oatmeal was torn open, and most of it was gone. The trail mix, the beef jerky, their food for the entire weekend. Tim rubbed his palm over his face, gave Max a sheepish smile, and pointed at an orange plastic cooler. "The food in there I haven't touched. Take it outside, please, right now." Max did as he was told, the numbness growing inside him. He overheard Newton saying, "What would our folks say about it?" and saw the questioning looks on his fellow scouts' faces. He put the cooler down and turned, ignoring them, heading back to Tim. A gust of wind pulled the cabin door shut behind him. He dug his feet into the floor. He didn't want to be anywhere near the stranger. "Prop a chair under the doorknob," Tim said, pouring scotch into a jelly glass. "I don't want them coming in." In the cabin's light, Max now saw how much the scoutmaster had changed in the hours they'd been gone. His chest was sucked inward where his rib cage met. His shoulders arrowed down and his neck stuck between them like a bean plant threading up a bamboo pole. His fingers spider-crept over the bottle. They looked spiderish themselves. Max remembered something his father had said about Tim. "Dr. Riggs has GP hands, real meat hooks. He doesn't have surgeon's hands. A surgeon's hands are weirdly delicate, like they've got extra joints. Nosferatu hands, the sort of pale and freaky things you could imagine reaching out of the shadows to grab you." Well, Scoutmaster Tim had surgeon's hands now. Tim caught the question in Max's eyes. He said, "Yeah, I think so, buddy. He coughed something up on me last night. Rock slime, I figure, but since then I've lost 20 pounds in a day." He spoke dreamily with awestruck bafflement. "At least 20. More every minute." Max could tell his scoutmaster was trying to stay calm, to look at this situation as a doctor, but his diminished body was trembling with insuppressible jackrabbit fear. A single word looped through Max's head. "Run, run, 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 run." He didn't, though. Perhaps it had something to do with their long history, the innate trust he placed in his scoutmaster. Maybe it was Pavlovian. When an adult asked for help, Max offered it. A man would have to be pretty desperate to ask a kid, wouldn't he? Scoutmaster Tim upended the glass. Rivulets of scotch spilled down the sides of his mouth. He stared radish-eyed at the boy. "This is not just for me, Max. It's for you and the others, too." Max thought back to a night years ago when his father had gotten hurt on the softball diamond. His team was playing the police union's team, captained by Kent's father. Max's father was the catcher, and on the final play of the ninth inning, score tied at 10-all, big Jeff Jenks steamed around third base, chugging hard for home. The cutoff man got the ball to Max's dad a good 10 yards ahead of Jenks's arrival. League softball rules stated that the catcher didn't need to apply a tag, so there was no earthly reason for a runner to plow into the catcher in hopes of popping the ball loose. That hadn't stopped Jenks from smashing his 250 pounds into Max's dad, who weighed 160 soaking wet, pancaking him at home plate. Max heard the high, sweet crack, which lingered under the vapor halogen spotlights. His father stood woozily, his arm hanging at a funny angle, bent back at the elbow, the lower half dangling like a cooked noodle. A shard of bone protruded from the joint, shining wetly under the lights. The second baseman had driven his father's car to the ER. Max sat in the back seat, his father in front. He leaned over the seat rest, smiling gamely. "It's okay, Maximilian. It's just a flesh wound," he said, repeating a line from one of their favorite movies. At the hospital, Max's dad sat on a bed encircled by a white curtain. Max wasn't allowed to sit with him because, as his dad said, "This is bound to be gross." So he'd only heard the rattle of the bone setter's tray and the crisp, blood-jangling click as his father's broken bone was set back in place. When the curtain withdrew, there he was, his arm in a sling and a tired, doped-up smile on his face. Jeff Jenks showed up to say he was sorry, but not really. Some men are incapable of offering a sincere apology, Max realized. Something in their nature refuses it, so instead they frame it as an accident, a misunderstanding, or a "sorry you're so upset" sort of thing that placed subtle blame on the other person for making such a big deal. Kent was there too, and told Max he was sorry about what happened, which wasn't an apology either. Max would always remember that glint of pride in Kent's eye. Afterward, Max's father drove them home. "Can you drop the transmission into drive, son? I can't manage it." They drove through streets wrapped in darkness, his father palm-guiding the wheel. "Getting old, kiddo," his father smiled, "and I'm barely hanging on to the getting part." A sudden fear had stolen over the crown of Max's skull. Fear and sadness intermingled, so powerful he wanted to cry. Up until that night, he'd sincerely believed that his father was invincible. He was mammothly strong, capable of reshingling a house or chopping down trees with a sharp axe. But that night he'd looked frail, tired, and vaguely spooked. Vulnerable. Something Max had never seen. All bodies fail, he realized. They fall to pieces in pieces, bit by torturous bit, and a man had to watch it fall apart around him. Max now thought of this as he looked at the scoutmaster and shivered. "I'll need your help, Max. I'll need it quite a lot in the next few minutes." Max said, "What do you want me to do?" At 14, Max was a little smaller than average, but there was a wideness to his shoulders and a thickness to his chest. He moved with a litheness that was not at all common for boys his age. Most of them were made of knees and elbows, all held together with scabs. His face was Rockwellian, the bristle-brush red hair and star spray of freckles over his cheeks. He looked like a more compact and muscular Opie. What set Max apart from the other boys was his reservoir of remoteness and cool self-control. Tim didn't believe his father had inculcated this into him. Reggie Kirkwood was a good man, but flighty as a hummingbird, prone to gossip and drink. Tim had seen the same cool quality in some of his classmates at med school who'd gone on to become the top blades at Johns Hopkins or Beth Israel. It wasn't exactly cockiness, more an absence of panic or hesitation. They trusted their instincts, and they trusted their hands to carry those instincts into action. Tim would try not to ask too much of the boy during the coming operation. but even asking him to be there at all was a terrible request. HAL 9000's maddeningly reasonable voice echoed this. Tim, I think you're losing it. Tim could see HAL in his mind's eye, a reflective glass eye, very dark, a dot of redness expanding and contracting like a dilated pupil. And now you're taking a child down the rabbit hole with you. Don't listen to that bullshit, the other, more comforting voice boomed. This is your duty as a doctor. What other choice? Just watch this man die? And you can't do this alone, can you? He couldn't. It was that simple. Tim switched on the soldering iron to let it heat. I've doped him up. It wasn't true anesthetic. Two crushed Vicodin discovered in a forgotten pocket of his backpack. He'd been prescribed it years ago while recuperating from a calf infarction. It could very well be expired, but what the hell? Better than nothing. He shouldn't wake up. Tim gripped the blankets gathered at the man's throat. Ready? Max nodded. Tim pulled the blankets away. Max couldn't keep the look of horror off his face. It was instinctive, what most would feel when faced with a member of humankind who no longer looked like he belonged to the species. The stranger didn't wholly resemble a man anymore, more like something a dull-witted child might have drawn with a crayon. His body was lines, his arms were scribbles, his fingers were calligraphic spiders. The skin draped his ribcage with terrible intimacy, pinching around each rib to show the striation of muscle. His sternum was a knot, his pelvis a gruesome hinged wishbone. The skin of his face had the patina of old copper, and was sucked so tight to his skull that Max could see the glaring rings of bone around his eye sockets. His ears protruded like jug handles, so thin that they curled inward like charring paper. Unbelievable. My God, even his cartilage is disintegrating, Tim said in horrified awe. He looks like the oldest man who's ever lived, Max thought. His stomach was the only robust thing about him, a tightly swollen bulge. It looked like he had swallowed a volleyball. I'm going to do something called a gastrostomy, Tim said. I'll make a small incision over the outer third of the left rectus muscle, so basically here. He drew his finger below the edge of the man's lowest rib. It should be a short trip into his stomach. Very little visceral or abdominal fat to get through. Is there any fat? Tim said. His body must have started eating its muscle a while ago. I have to worry about the liver. But I can pretty much see it right now. He pointed to a soft ridge along the man's side. It has probably shut down its function. It's in a state of premortification and it's hardening fast. Can you save him? To Max, it seemed impossible. This man already belonged less to Max's world, the living one, than to his father's, the world of the motionless dead in the mortuary vaults. I can't say. It's some kind of voodoo that he's still alive, but we have to do something, Max. Tim stared searchingly at the boy, his eyelid going plicka-plicka. Don't we? Max wasn't sure. Why was it their responsibility? Maybe this man had done it to himself, a result of bad luck or bad decisions. Tim tried to smile, but couldn't quite get his muscles to cooperate. More the leer of a crazed loon. His face kept shifting polarities, giddy to mortified, great forces working beneath its surface. Max wondered, did the Scoutmaster really want to save the man, or only investigate for symptoms of his own condition? He contemplated the selfishness of that as the soldering gun sent up pin curls of smoke. What do you think it is? Max asked softly. Tim picked up the scalpel. He stared at his hand until it stopped trembling. I've stopped trying to guess, Max. I'll open him up a little, just a little, okay? Tim thought back to med school, an operating theater where a doctor instructor leaned over his patient and said, This is the God moment, folks. You hold it all in your hands right now, so honor the body beneath your blade. Tim would do his best to honor this man's body, what was left of it. "Ready, Max?" The boy nodded. "Just follow my instructions. Don't be scared if I yell or get demanding. It won't be your fault." He offered a strained and cheerless smile. "I'll try not to raise my voice." Tim positioned the scalpel over the man's flesh, which was stretched so tight that he could see the individual pores, a million tiny mouths stretched into silent screams. He lacked the cool confidence of a true blade. You could wake one of those guys out of a dead sleep, shove him into the operating theater, and stick a knife in his hand, and he'd say, "I've got it from here," and get down to cutting. That was a rare gift. Tim had been given a smaller gift, which was why he'd ended up as a small-town GP wielding tongue depressors and blood pressure cuffs. He'd always been okay with that, too, but as the scalpel hummed over the man's flesh, he dearly wished for the unerring self-belief of his med school pals. The man's skin opened up as if it had been aching to do that very thing. A V of split flesh followed the blade as it sliced below the ribs, widening out like the wake of a yacht. Everything inside existed in shades of white, the silver skin draping the man's ribs and the layer of muscle. "Soldering iron, Max." Tim cauterized the severed veins. Medical instruments were often just precision variations of the same tools handymen used. "Gauze," he said. Tim dabbed the blood out of the half-inch deep slit in the man's torso, then absentmindedly dabbed the sweat off his forehead. The stranger's breathing was unaltered. Tim wasn't surprised. A single baby aspirin would be enough to knock him on his ass. He may already have slipped into a starvation coma. Hal 9000 spoke up. "Timothy Ogden Riggs, are you sure you're making the right decision? I think you should stop." The new, conflicting voice, the under-voice, as Tim now thought of it, boomed back. "How could you stop now, even if you wanted to? Don't you want to know, Tim? Don't you need to know?" The blade slit through bands of taut sinew to reveal the stomach lining. Milky pale and fingered with blue veins, Tim was reminded of childhood trips to his Scottish grandmother's home and the boiled sheep's stomach she'd laid out on the kitchen counter waiting to be made into haggis. They had looked like deflated, overthick birthday balloons. "Jesus. Jesus Christ." Tim wished so dearly that he were in a hospital right now, a sterilized surgical suite with nurses and orderlies buzzing about like helpful bees. Most desperately of all, he wished the blade weren't in his hand. "It doesn't have to be, Tim," Hal 9000 said softly. "Just put the blade down. Take Max's hand, or maybe you shouldn't touch him just in case. Stitch this poor man up and leave the cabin. Both of you, just go." The undervoice, nasty and baiting. "You fucking coward. Grow a set of balls, man. In for a penny, in for a pound, and you're neck deep now, sonny boy." Tim drew the blade along the stomach lining. A gout of gray ichor oozed around the lips of the incision like congestive mucus, then more white, another layer of tightened white flesh. "Gauze," Tim said tentatively. Max put a square in his hand. Tim dabbed away the warm ichor. The smell was horrible, like rancid grease. This made no sense. He'd cut into the stomach, hadn't he? He hadn't expected to find a dark vault, but he had expected a cavity, an expulsion of pressurized stomach gas, something. It seemed as if he'd simply sliced into a secondary layer of stomach lining, which was impossible. Was this man's stomach the equivalent of a Russian doll? Stomach inside stomach inside stomach? "Something very disturbing is happening here, Tim," Hal 9000's voice, indistinct and watery. "Something is horribly, drastically wrong." Tim felt a species of fear enter his heart that he hadn't felt since his stint as a foreign aid doctor in Afghanistan. Although he'd been scared most of his time there, it had at least been a coherent fear, fear that a bomb might come whistling out of the chalky desert sky and through the canvas roof of his jury-rigged triage ward, or fear that some human grenade might dash inside their compound and pull the pin on himself. But the fear he felt now was childlike, dreamy. There was no reference point to it. The man was just sick, that was all. He didn't have multiple stomachs. There had to be a rational cause for all of this. It was a serious occlusion, of course, but there was no reason, really no reason, for his eyes to be drawn to that ribbed whiteness within the duller whiteness of the stomach's lining, and for his mind to fuse shut at the possibilities. Jesus, he was hungry. Why had he given the boys all that food? They would be fine until the boat came. But he needed it. Now. He'd packed it and paid for it. By rights, it was his. Tim stared at his patient. The man's lips were so thin that they'd been twisted into a permanent grin. He seemed to be laughing at Tim, mocking his hunger.
"Hey, buddy," the undervoice popped up. "What would you do for a Klondike bar?"
"Shut up," Tim croaked.
"Whoa, no need to get testy." The voice had gone vile and poisonous. "You deserve a break today, pal. 2 all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun."
"Scoutmaster Tim." Tim couldn't take his eyes off the man's face, lying there like a ghoul, smiling. "Tim? Tim? Tim?" Tim turned dazedly toward Max. The boy's eyes were bulging out of the whitened mask of his face. His nostrils were dilated like a bull's before it charged at a red cape.
"What?"
Which was when Tim felt something touch his hand. Which was when he looked down. Which was when he saw it. Which was when he screamed.
Chapter 13. Max saw it first. A white stub protruding where Scoutmaster Tim had made the incision. It looked silly. Like a balloon, maybe. One of those long, skinny ones that the clowns made balloon animals with at the Cavendish County Fair. Max had gotten one last year, a giraffe. The clown who'd made it had approached Max near the Shetland pony pen. He'd been short and dumpy, in slappy red shoes with the toes all squashed like they'd been stamped on by an elephant. The grease paint on the clown's face had been badly applied over his stubbled cheeks. The red circles around his eyes were melting down his face in the heat, making him look like a sick beagle. His clown suit was dingy, with yellow patches under the armpits. When he smiled, Max saw brown grime slotted between his teeth. When he blew up the balloon, Max got a good whiff of him. Rank sweat and something odder, scarier, a hint of shaved iron. The clown gave the balloon cruel twists with his nub-like fingers. The balloon squealed as if in pain. The giraffe was all neck, a bulb of head, thumb-like legs. Max pictured the poor thing dragging its neck through the dirt across the Serengeti. What now came out of the man's stomach reminded Max of that. A balloon. Or as though the man's belly had blown a funny little bubble. Except this bubble was solid. Max could tell that immediately. Solid and weirdly muscular. Whatever it was, it relaxed back inside the man. The balloon, or cord, or tube, which was maybe the closest corollary. A thick, shiny tube, like an inner tube, but white instead of black, filled not with air, but with some kind of thick, pulsing fluid. The tube flattened back into the incision. Tim and Max watched, transfixed in the perfectly still eye of horror. The tube curved around in the man's stomach. It seemed to be made of different parts, different elements. It reminded Max of the snake ball Eve had found that afternoon. A few dozen snakes twisted into a ball having sex. Copulating, as his health teacher, Mrs. Fitzu, would say, stringing the word out. Copulating. The thing flexed,
constricting. The man's spine curled up as if parts of the thing were twined all through him. The idea that this tube could be spread out into every part of the man was terrifying. Scoutmaster Tim, Max's words came out in a papery whisper, his mind tightening shut in baffled horror. What? Tim didn't answer. The only sound was the creak of the floorboards beneath the man. A few of the cauterized veins split open, dark arterial blood wept down the man's pale skin. The tube swelled monstrously, pushing itself out of the rubbery slit in a sudden surge. It emerged incredibly fast, its whiteness stretching to a milky translucence. Tim and Max shielded their faces instinctively, petrified it would explode, splattering them with the contents of its alien body. What could possibly be inside such a thing? Its guts were visible through that sheer web, crazed threshings and phantom pulsations. Max felt as if he were staring through a large streaked window into... God, into what? His fear was wetted to such a fine edge that he could actually feel it now, a disembodied ball of baby fingers inside his stomach, tickling him from the inside. That's what mortal terror felt like, he realized. Tiny fingers tickling you from the inside. The tube deflated back inside the man's stomach for an instant, inflated even more so, and deflated again. Its movement echoed a huge lung inhaling and exhaling. Only a few seconds had ticked off the clock, but Max felt as if a minor eternity had passed. Everything moved in slow motion. Then, with a brutal whiplash, the world sped up. The tube propelled itself out of the man's side in a series of fierce pulsations, or what Max's science teacher, Mr. Lowry, would have called peristaltic flexes. It came with a sly squishing noise, like very wet clay squeezed in a tightened fist. The balloon or tube or whatever it was became something else. It twisted and split and became a thick white loop. It looked a little like the U-magnets Max used to push around iron filings in Mr. Lowry's class. Could it be a hernia? Max's Uncle Frank had one of those. He'd taken off his truss at a family picnic and showed it to him. It had looked like a fist pushing against the flatness of his stomach. I tried to pick up 2 sacks of cement, Maximilian, Uncle Frank had told him. 1 sack too many. The pressure forced a little bitty bit of my innards to squeeze right through the muscle. Uncle Frank had then made a rude farting noise. Out she come, slick as goose poop. It's peeking through like a clown nose, huh? See it there? Peek-a-boo. Maxie, I see you. Uncle Frank had given the herniated intestine a little squeeze. Honk, honk. Oh, I feel my lunch moving through. Yep, there goes the cornbread. Uncle Frank had not been invited to the following year's picnic. But this wasn't a hernia. Logic told Max so. A hernia was just what his mind had feverishly cobbled together to excuse what he was seeing. A hernia didn't move. A hernia didn't pulsate like that. This thing. The loop became a pale ribbed tube, roughly 7 inches long, thicker than a garden hose, tapered slightly at its tip. It seemed to be made of millimeter-thick rings stacked atop one another. Each ring was gently rounded at its edge. Pearlescent beads squeezed from its surface, clinging to the tube like grains of sand to wet skin. Get back, Tim breathed. Max, you get the hell back. The tube paused. Max got the weirdest sense that it was presenting itself. The gaudiest bell at the debutante's ball. Appendages began to unglue themselves from its trunk. It reminded Max of the time he'd come upon a half-hatched bird struggling out of its egg, its wings pulling free of its body, all stuck with webby strands of mucus. This looked much the same, or like a Swiss Army knife unfolding its many blades and attachments. These smaller appendages unkinked with the slow, showy grace of a contortionist. They unfurled tortuously in the cabin's dim light, making gluey lip-smack noises. They looked like the fleshy leaves of desert plants. Succulents, those plants were called. Max learned that in science class, too. The very tips of these appendages split in half, lolling open. Max saw tiny fishbone teeth studding each mouth.
It was sickeningly beautiful.
Peekaboo, Maxie. I see you.
There's an emotion that operates on a register above sheer terror. It lives on a mindless dog whistle frequency. Its existence is in itself a horrifying discovery, like scanning a shortwave radio in the dead of night and tuning in to an alien wavelength. A heavy whisper barely climbing above the static, voices muttering in a brutal language that human tongues could never speak. Watching that live tube now hunt toward his scoutmaster like a blind snake, Max hit that register. Tim, Tim, Tim! As a doctor, Tim had seen plenty of things in human stomachs. Rubber bath plugs and toy cars and Baltic coins and wedding rings. Most of these could be purged using simple regurgitative or saline laxative procedures. The human form held few surprises for him anymore. But when that white tube threaded out of the incision and tipped toward him as if it were ascending an imaginary staircase, Tim squealed. A shocked pig-like sound. He couldn't get a grip on his sudden fear. It slipped through the safety bars of his mind and threaded, wormed, into the shadowy pockets where nightmares grew. His scalpel slashed wildly, severing the leading inch of the flickering white tube. The amputated nub fell between Tim's feet. It writhed and leaked brown fluid. Its plant-like appendages studded with tiny mouths gaped open and shut. Tim's arms pinwheeled madly as he tipped backward, landing awkwardly on his ass. The remainder of the tube sucked itself back into the incision like a strand of spaghetti going into a greedy child's mouth, whipping and snapping and spraying stinking brown gouts.
"Cover your mouth!" Tim screamed. "Don't let any of it touch you!"
Fists battering the door so hard that dust sifted down from the rafters, the boys' massing voices dominated by Kent's.
"Tim! Max! What's going on? Open the door!"
The stranger's body rocked side to side. His feet slipped off the Chesterfield and hit the floor with a brittle rattle. The tube now shot straight up out of the wound, rising in a monstrous ripple. A foot, 2 feet, 3 feet of oily tube weaved out of the man. The dead man, Tim prayed. The dead man who, please God, feels none of this. Like a headless albino cobra out of an Indian fakir's basket, it threshed like some obscene bullwhip, leaking brownish fluid. It stood quivering for a long instant, flicking back and forth. It looked as if it was tasting the air, or hunting for smaller and weaker creatures within striking distance. Which was when the stranger woke up. His eyelids fluttered, then his eyes went wide, wider than ever should be possible. It was as if the man had awoken from a terrible dream, only to find that those terrors were dwarfed by those in the waking world. He loosed a volley of piercing screams. They almost sounded like the snarls of a terrified dog.
"Stay away, Max!" Tim yelled. "Stay back!"
The stranger reached instinctively for the thing coming out of him. His hand died before reaching it, his fingers softening into a caress. His eyes were miserably bright and aware, bulging with pure shock and horror. The eyes of a little boy who'd come face to face with the nameless horror lurking under his bed.
"Ugh,"
was the single syllable that came out of his mouth, a caveman's grunt of disgust.
"Ugh, ugh."
"Tim," Kent screamed, "open this freaking door right now."
The tips of a boy's head bobbed at the cabin's lone high window, a pair of hands hooked on the sill. Ephraim's hands, they had to be Eve's, set to boost their owner up for a look inside. Tim realized he was watching a man die. He'd seen it before, of course, but Max hadn't. Here was a man neither of them knew the first thing about, and now, in a way that was somehow obscene, Max would witness this man during the most private moment any human being ever would have, the moment of his death. The man's eyes rolled back. He exhaled. Mercifully, his eyes closed. The tube dropped onto the man's chest like a length of rope. It lay in a loose coil for a moment before twitching and crawling under the man's shirt. Tim imagined it working up the man's neck and into his mouth, thrashing its way down his throat and back into his stomach to link up with the rest of itself. Eating its own tail? Or its own head? Out of his peripheral vision, he saw Max reaching for the soldering iron.
"Don't!" Tim said. "Don't you fucking dare, Max!"
The tube wrapped around the man's bird-thin neck, encircling it in a greasy ringlet. It elongated slightly, the many rings that constituted its body thinning with cruel, purposeful tension.
"Jesus Christ, it's constricting," Tim's mind yammered. "It's choking him."
Tim tried to stand, but his legs were cramped with the sudden dump of lactic acid. He pulled himself forward. His hand slipped on the severed link of tube, which pulped under his palm like a rotten banana. The man's face had turned the blue of a sun-bleached parking ticket. Tim was shocked that this thing...
"It's a worm," the undervoice said. "A fucking worm, that's what the fuck it is, and you better wrap your head around that, buddy, old pal of mine."
Had the strength to do what it was doing. He dragged himself forward, scrabbling for the scalpel that had skittered under the Chesterfield's skirt. He hunted amid the dust bunnies and insect corpses while a thick, hopeless whimper built in his throat. Kent's fists pounded on the door, but that sound was far away now, a dream noise not attached to the waking world. The tube flexed. The man's neck bent at a sudden, unnatural angle. His body stiffened before going limp.
"Oh, no," Tim thought. His next thought was, "Oh, thank God."
The tube released from the man's throat, retreating once again into the incision. Tim grabbed at it through the man's shirt. The thought of touching it directly brought on a mind-numbing revulsion. He pictured it feeling like a lubed length of nautical rope burning through his fingers. But when his hand closed around it, the tube was warm and pulsating and horribly smooth. Its flagellate body was already going limp as if it had a pinhole leak. He slashed the scalpel through the man's shirt and through the thing's body. It was like cutting through a ripe, stinking cheese. It took no effort at all. He saw inside the severed portion. There was no identifiable anatomy to the thing, no vertebrae or organs. It was full of loose, brownish goo, some massive, carnivorous leech. The unsevered portion slid sluggishly back inside the wound. Its skin continued to weep those pearly pustules. The man's stomach deflated. Brown filth bubbled out of the wound. Half-digested bits of Chesterfield foam bobbed on its surface. Squinting, Max thought he saw something deeper inside. Two objects, long and glinting, their angles man-made. Tim and Max stood, breathing heavily in the dim light of the cabin. The hacked-off portion of the tube slid out of the vent in the man's shirt, hitting the floor and wadding up like a huge tube sock. The brown goo had run over Tim's fingers and down his knuckles like watery molasses. Overcome by instinctive revulsion, Tim wiped his fingers on his pants, and when even that closeness was too much, he unbuttoned them, yanked them down and off, wiped his hands on the fabric, and hurled the pants into the corner. He stood shivering in his underwear. His thighs were unbearably thin, knobbed sticks on a forest floor.
"Jesus," he said softly, then gave Max a sharp look. "Did you swallow any of that stuff? Get any in your mouth or eyes?"
"I don't think so. That's not good enough."
"No,"
Max said. "I didn't get anything in me."
"You kept the gauze over your mouth the whole time?"
"Yes."
"Okay. Good."
Tim staggered to the table and drank scotch right out of the bottle. "If you drink whiskey, you'll never get worms, Max." Kent pounded on the door unrelentingly.
"Tim! Tim!"
The scoutmaster stumbled to the sink and washed his hands. He did this for some time. The hard island water made it difficult to get a good lather going. His legs trembled like a newborn foal's. When he was finished, his hands were a raw, nail-scraped red. Did it matter anymore? He shuffled into the bedroom, not speaking to Max, coming out with pants on. He kicked the chair away from the door. He had to kick three times. He seemed to lack the energy to do it properly. And flung the door open to catch Kent, red-faced and fuming, his hand raised in mid-knock. Get away from the fucking door, Kent. Tim's voice belonged to something recently dug from its grave. Get your ass far, far away. Chapter 14. Tim sat at the fire and explained what he could. Most of it failed to make sense to him at all. A worm? Yeah, Newton, a worm. Not a nightcrawler or something you dig out of your mom's garden. A tapeworm. Tim had experienced